I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to The Parenthood. Baby loss is something we've talked about a lot on this podcast and something we've had some of the most positive feedback about. Because when you lose a baby, when the excitement, hopes and dreams for that new life are dashed, you often feel like you've unceremoniously been chucked out of the shiny new club you just got excited about joining. And you feel like you're the only one who is experiencing this. Feelings about having another baby differ hugely. Some women feel like the sooner they can get pregnant, the sooner their gaping wound of grief will heal. And others are terrified of the prospect of another loss. And because you've been bitten once by the lone predator of loss, how can you control your anxiety around it happening again? Well, joining me today, I've got Michelle Tolfrey, a clinical psychologist and mother to Orla, who was stillborn, and one-year-old Esme. She writes that, "With the loss of Orla, I suddenly found myself to be the person needing support. I was isolated, vulnerable, and unsure how I would be able to cope. So I began to write. And what was born out of tragedy was Dear Orla, a blog that proved to be supremely helpful for other people navigating the unanticipated path of loss." Michelle, thank you so much for coming to join me today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And thank you also for being so generous and honest about your experiences. I know for me, when I experienced stillbirth myself, it was so inspiring to hear other people talk honestly about their experiences. It almost gave me permission to do so. And for me, that was a big part of the healing process. And I think until you're in that situation, you don't realize quite how powerful other people are. So I know it's not easy to be honest and open. And I know you also put yourself out to sort of criticism online, but keep doing it. It's an amazing thing that you're doing. I wanted to talk a bit about the process of writing, the cathartic process of writing. I mean, I know that Dear Orla was initially a series of letters you wrote to Orla.
Yeah. Although, I mean, not, they weren't ones that actually we shared on the blog. They're letters that my husband and I wrote. We wrote a letter every single day for the first year of her life, or what would have been her life even. And we've written intermittently since. But yeah, this idea that we found some kind of healing and a way of processing things through writing to her, because she wasn't here to talk to or to parents in the way that we'd hoped we would be.
And there's something about writing words rather than saying them, because they stay with you.
Yeah, it's very, I sometimes go back and read those letters, and it's quite painful sometimes because it really transports you back to that moment. You know, you can, memory's a funny thing, isn't it? Like you can think that you remember things, but actually when you go back and read something or maybe look at a photo, you can feel it. You can really palpably feel how you felt in that moment.
And did you write together? Was it a process you did together?
Kind of. So we actually set up this private Instagram account, and we would write letters one day. We'd alternate days. So actually,
just the two of you was on this Instagram account.
Yeah, yeah. So it still exists. And yeah, each day I would do one letter, and then the next day Andy would write a letter. And I think what I found really helpful about that was there were times that I would then go in and just read his letters that he'd written that day. And it just gave me an insight into where he was at. It's really hard sometimes to talk about these things. You sort of fall back into a way of coping day to day. And, you know, you kind of get on with the things you have to, like going to work or you know, buying the shopping or doing those things that you do to survive, but you might not always talk about actually what am I thinking about and how am I feeling. So it was really good that we were able to communicate in that way.
It's also really intense having a conversation with someone and sort of admitting, especially if the other person is grieving too, you don't want to burden them necessarily with how you're feeling. And so the idea of writing something that you may or may not read then or it might be later is obviously, I mean, it's a brilliant idea. Who had this idea?
I mean, I'm gonna claim it. I think it was my idea. I'm pretty sure it was. I woke up the next day. We come home from hospital the day that Ola was born, and then the morning after, I just remember looking over at the empty crib next to the bed and just thinking, oh my, like, how on earth are we gonna get through this? And I mean, I did use Instagram back then, but not massively. But I just thought, actually, this is what I'm going to do. I'm just going to set up this account. And there and then in bed, I just sat up and set it up, wrote my first letter, turned to Andy and said, have a look at this. What do you think? And literally from that moment, that's what, yeah, it was kind of born from there.
Because Ola was born after a normal pregnancy, no concerns about the pregnancy. No. So her stillbirth was a real shock. I mean, how aware of you were of stillbirth were you? I mean, did it even cross your mind?
It did not cross my mind. Like, I genuinely, I just don't think it registered. I don't think I really ever thought about it, with, you know, had been sort of spoken to about it. I think you know that babies die because you think, well, if they're born and they're unwell or something really terrible goes wrong during birth or afterwards. But I just never had this concept that you could get to full term in pregnancy, be absolutely healthy, and your baby die before labour even starts. It just was so shocking to me.
And I mean, for me, I'd not known anyone who'd had a stillbirth.
No.
So while I knew it happened, I thought it was so rare that I'd never know anyone who would experience it. And then when it happens to you, you just think, oh, I remember thinking, this must be a dream.
Yeah.
This can't be real.
Yeah, I had exactly the same. Literally.
And I suppose then to some extent writing it, you know, for me it was really important saying those words, my baby was stillborn, my baby died. That was a really important part of that adjustment, that realization that this was my reality. And I suppose, you know, writing too is so cathartic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it just kind of makes it real. But there's evidence that she existed as well, that she wasn't a dream, that although this felt like a terrible nightmare that was happening, she did exist and she was real.
And then 11 months later, you gave birth to Esme. So 2 months after losing Ola, you were pregnant again.
Yeah, I think it was about 3 months. I'm a very compliant person. I think we were told don't try for 12 weeks or something. And I do as I'm told. That's just how I am. And yeah, so we waited and we were very, very lucky that we fell pregnant that very, very quickly. So the first year of grieving was very entangled with pregnancy after loss. So it was I kind of look back and think, gosh, did I dissociate for that time? Because it was such an overwhelming year. Yeah, you kind of think, gosh, how did I survive?
And did you, after Ola died, did you immediately think, I need to have another baby?
Yeah.
Did you just think, I can't even think twice about this. This is absolutely what I need to do.
Yes and no. I mean, I think I oscillated because there were moments. I remember when I was in labour with Ola, just kind of going, turning to Andy and saying, I just think this is a sign that I'm just not meant to be a mum.
To clarify, this, you knew by this stage that Ola had died and they'd induced your labour.
Induced labour, knew that, I mean, there's a bit of your brain that thinks maybe they got it wrong. She's going to come out crying. It'll be fine. But yeah, induced labour. We'd lost a baby before her. And I just felt like that, you know, I wasn't meant to be a mum, so maybe this was just my sign. And to be honest, if he, you know, I think if he'd said, yeah, I don't think I could go through this again, I think I would have, I don't know, there's a part of me that thinks I would have just said, no, we can't do this. But then there's this other bit that's just so, it's so primal. I think this hormonal and this animal instinct that I've got to this point and I need to be a mum, and I need to be a mum that has a baby that I can take home and mother, not one that I got a mother through other means. I needed one that was in my arms.
And it's so difficult because, you know, with you, you had two kind of crazy, unusual circumstances. Mm. You had an ectopic pregnancy, you had a stillbirth. Neither of them could be explained, which on the one hand was bad because actually sometimes it's nice to know a reason. But on the other hand, you know, it's not like there was a big problem with you and people were saying there's a really high chance of this happening again. I mean, presumably having had a stillbirth, your increase of having increased risk of having a stillbirth is slightly more, but it's still tiny if they can't find a sort of specific reason.
I think that's it. It's reassuring, and it's not, because if there was a cause, there might be a treatment.
Yeah,
but this was just like, well, you know, it's like thunder. It, you know, not thunder, lightning. It'll you know, not strike again.
And when you first find out you're pregnant, what were those feelings? You know, usually when you find out you're pregnant, you're sort of a little bit fearful, probably, and quite excited. But obviously, you know, you were in the midst of the most raw part of your grief process. What were your emotions around that?
It was, I remember we were away, actually. We'd gone away for a few months to, Andy was cycling the length of America to, when we were raising money, fundraising. And I remember I'd convinced myself that it wasn't happening that month. I was just so convinced, no, my period's coming. And I was just devastated. I was just in a really bad place. And
you were devastated because you thought you weren't pregnant.
Yeah. And I was just really, someone had announced a pregnancy to me that weekend. And I was just feeling just so vulnerable. And then did the test. And it was just this really surreal, oh my goodness, I'm pregnant. And this, it's like, I don't know, it's a bit like, it was just very muted. I felt happy. I felt joy. I felt relief. But it was so, I felt like the world was quite cotton wool like, it was all very muted. And then suddenly had this wave of, oh my goodness, how am I going to get through this? How am I going to keep this baby alive? How am I going to survive these next few months? It's very confusing, I would say.
And what about your feelings around sort of Orla? I mean, was there any feeling that you were betraying her, that you were replacing her? I mean, we have such complex feelings that are so often, you know, ridiculous when you look at them from a rational point of view. But
it's, I think I had this range of emotions. That wasn't an initial thought or feeling. But I think as Esme's pregnancy progressed, I became quite anxious about what gender this baby was going to be. And I think because we didn't find out the gender with Orla, and I was just like, I need to find out, because I need to make sure that I can give this baby a separate identity, because it was all happening so quickly. I was like, I just need to know that I'm not pretending that this is going to be, you know, Orla, because it's not. This is a separate baby, a different baby. And so we actually did find out the gender, so I gave myself some time to process and give this baby its own personality and identity.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
And how supportive were the NHS? How supportive were they in your pregnancy and understanding of the emotional turmoil that you were experiencing?
I mean, I was so lucky. I had an incredible midwife, and that for me just made all the difference. Same midwife that I had with Orla. So she'd lived through everything with us. She was the first person, apart from Andy, first person I told that I was pregnant, you know, had her number, messaged her and was like, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? And she was my advocate all the way through. She was a case-holding midwife, so I saw her for every appointment. She came to my house and she was there for both births. And having someone who, it's like she could preempt the next stage that I was going to find difficult. So she would book appointments and she would book in like reassurance scans and CTG monitoring at the end of pregnancy. So I felt like she was one step ahead. So, I mean, I kind of think that she was a kind of core role. I didn't have a lot of different treatment, I guess. I did see a consultant, but I didn't feel like I had a very different package of care.
But you had that emotional support.
Yeah.
And the case loading midwife, she started looking after you once you know that Orla was dead, and so she looked after you during that labour, or was she already in the pregnancy?
She was already my midwife. I was so lucky. I was so lucky.
I mean, the anxiety, I think, would be, for me, would be such a big thing, because I think we all worry, don't we? Mm. We all worry exponentially, and that just increases once even when you are a parent. Mm. And if something that was unexplained happens to you that's so tragic, say that no one can say it's not going to happen again, because they might say it's so rarely going to happen, but it did. So mm-hmm. It's really difficult to sort of trust people.
Yeah.
How did you control that anxiety? And were you terrified? I mean, I can just imagine I would have been absolutely terrified.
Yeah, I was. I mean, I can only sort of liken it to being on a cliff edge, that you are constantly treading this line of feeling so anxious that something terrible is about to happen. And you can almost see it because you've lived it already. And then,
did you envisage it? Did you envisage having another stillborn baby?
Yeah, or that something else would happen. So for the first few weeks it was, this is going to be a miscarriage or another ectopic pregnancy, and then I'd lose my other tube. And then it was, stillbirth. And then, beyond then it's anything and everything. But everything became scary because I went back to work. That was one of my coping strategies, was to be busy, or busier than not being at work. And it was just, everything was scary. So even getting on the train, I'd have these images flash into my mind of, okay, the train's going to suddenly stop and someone's going to fall on me and it's going to kill the baby. And, everything became really scary. So it's not just thinking that history is going to repeat itself. It's that something, the world is dangerous. Suddenly everything felt really, really scary.
And that's a really normal thing to feel, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because your vision of the world as you knew it has completely shattered. When you have any kind of trauma, that what you thought of the world is, the world's generally safe and, yes, bad things happen, but it's rare. Once it's happened to you, how can you trust that something isn't going to happen again? So, yeah, it just all felt... I think I was just hypervigilant for 9 months and beyond.
And how do you manage that? How did you manage that in your pregnancy? Because there are obviously ways, quite effective ways, of controlling anxiety.
Yeah, and it's funny because obviously anxiety is something I've worked with for years as a psychologist. And I think there's a degree of being able to kind of identify some of those thoughts and try and rationalise them. But actually I found that sometimes that I almost felt like I was being kind of quite critical of my thoughts, like I shouldn't have those. And I think for me, a turning point was using more kind of mindfulness-based approaches to my anxiety. So I signed up and did the 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction course and really sort of practiced mindfulness, tried to do it kind of really actively every day, so that I was just noticing when I was anxious and not judging those thoughts and just being really compassionate to myself, saying, today you're feeling really anxious. What do you need? What do you need that's going to get you through the next hour, the next afternoon, the next day? And actually sometimes that was just calling someone for reassurance or not going to work or clearing my diary so that I could actually just sit and notice the baby moving. And I think for me that was a big turning point, because it was almost like making friends with anxiety and kind of going, this is part of this process. It's a normal reaction to a very abnormal situation that you're in. You've just got to find a way to dance with it rather than wrestle it. Because when you wrestle it, it's getting more power. You need to sort of kind of go, okay, I'm going to roll with this. I'm going to, I'm going to walk alongside you. I'm not going to try and fight you.
Because anxiety is a really important thing that we feel. It's kept us alive for,
absolutely,
in much more dangerous times.
Yeah.
Can't lose anxiety.
No.
It's about managing it. How about Andy? He must have been really anxious too.
I think he was, but he's a lot more laid back than me. And he, I think, is quite good at, he's just very good at, I think, keeping his emotions quite covered up.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no doubt that underneath he was very anxious, but he he's someone who keeps busy and throws himself into doing stuff. But certainly I think he, you know, I could see it in his eyes that there were times where I was like, I don't know if I can feel the baby moving, I need to go to hospital. And knowing that, I could see like a kind of glimmer in his eyes that, oh gosh, I hope we're not, I hope this isn't happening again.
And did you go to hospital a lot just to get checked out?
I did. I mean, there were fewer times that I turned up in a kind of state of crisis. I can probably count those on one hand, but that was because my midwife booked in so many reassurance CTG scans and monitoring. So from, I can't remember, it was from like 32 weeks or something, I was at hospital 3 times a week being monitored. So I always knew I've just got a couple of days to get through. I'm almost at the next one. It's fine. I mean, there were times that I just was like, I need something now. But I think already having those ones booked in made such a difference.
And obviously in that year of, you know, that time when you were pregnant, you would have had the anniversary of Ola's death.
Yeah, well, that was actually after Esme was born.
That was after Esme was born.
Yeah.
And what about the time, we'll talk about that in a minute, but what about, you know, passing the gestation that Ola was born? I mean, was that a relief to get past there or...?
I think I was, basically, I got to that point about 2 days before my induction. So we'd, because at 37 weeks, it's not like if she'd passed earlier, then I would have kind of gone through that much sooner. So there never felt like a safe point. We agreed that I would be induced slightly later so that we didn't have exactly the same kind of induction time or gestation. But I do remember on the day that I turned 37 weeks, or that weekend, because she died on a Sunday, it was that Sunday that I completely kind of flipped out. And I think I thought I was going to be okay. I thought, oh, no, I'll be fine. I don't need to, you know, I won't need extra monitoring. But yeah, I did. I needed to go up and have more reassurance. But yeah, because they were both born at 37 plus two. With me.
And so what was the birth like with Esme?
I mean, it was incredible. I feel really lucky that I can say this, but I feel like it was such an incredible experience. Birth was such a thing that interested me so much in Ola's pregnancy. I was fascinated by this whole process that you can get to this point where you've got this, you know, quite big baby in you and you somehow have to sort of get them out, and that there are strategies that might help you to get through that. So I did hypnobirthing, I did loads of yoga. And I felt really proud of how Ola's birth went, given that mentally I was just all over the place. And physically it's very hard to give birth to a baby that's already passed because you have to do all the work. They can't do anything to help. And I think I was nervous, but kind of in some ways looking forward to Esme's birth, because I just thought, you know, maybe I can have the birth that I really wanted with Ola. And again, we were induced, but I was really lucky that actually we were just induced with pessaries and having my waters burst, and had a, you know, vaginal birth, just used a TENS machine and breathing. And there were moments that were really funny and quite comical in her birth, with someone bringing my dinner in just as she was crowning. And I'm just like, what on earth is going on here? But actually it was something I look back on really fondly. It was an amazing birth. And to have her come out and cry was, I feel really tearful thinking about it.
Yeah, you would. I mean, it's but you know, confused emotions,
very,
you know, that thing
very,
that you've been
yeah
wanting to hear. And you know, I think when most parents hear that, that's just unadulterated joy.
Yeah.
And yet when you've experienced loss and you've experienced the birth of a baby that didn't cry, it's just,
they're just
complicated,
pulled apart. They really are. And just, I suppose it's little things like, you know, monitoring in labor and things like that that you just don't have when you know that you're going to have a baby who's died. There's, you know, there's just little things that you just think, okay, I didn't have this last time, this is really different. Yeah, it was incredible.
Do you think you bonded with Esme before she was born? Do you think you dared to?
No, I think not for a long time. Then we had the 20-week scan, or maybe it was a little bit later, and they discovered that she had a hole in her heart, which is, I think, is very, very common. A small hole and could have closed up before birth anyway. And I think it was at that point where I knew something was wrong. I could see in the sonographer's eyes, and she made us wait to kind of go into another room. And it was sitting in that corridor in the chair waiting, I was like, oh my God, I love this baby and I don't want to lose them. And I think up until that point, I'd just been quite detached. And it was then I was like, no, the stakes are high here. And I love this baby and I really want to be able to take them home. So I think from that point, there was more bonding, but it's just different. It's not the blissfully naive bonding that you have pre-loss. Mm.
And the hole in her heart was okay?
It was fine. She still had it at birth and she had an appointment, I think, when she was 4 weeks old, and it was fine after that. It's just, you know, another thing to navigate.
What you've written about a lot is that first year of Esme's life. The idea, which I think affects a lot of people, that you finally have what you wanted the whole time.
Yep.
And it's like, still life's not perfect.
It's not.
Because it's harder than you imagine, and it's kind of more boring than you imagine, and it's not filled with sort of light and perfection.
Nope.
And it's very difficult, even when you haven't suffered loss, to admit it's not all perfect the whole time.
Yeah,
but if you have, if you finally got the baby you so desperately wanted, and then to say, oh, God, there are times when I kind of wish I didn't have this.
Yeah.
It's a tough thing to admit.
It's really complex because I don't know, I think lots of other lost mums would say this, that once you lose a baby and you hear other people complaining about sleepless nights, or and you just like want to hiss in their face and go, like, you have no idea how lucky you are. I would never complain about this. I would it's better to, you know, be up with a crying baby than to be up crying because your baby died. And then you sort of bring a baby home and you kind of go, okay, this is really hard. This is, you know, there are moments that are so thankless, and you just feel like you're on this kind of machine of, you know, treadmill of feed and change. And also you're carrying this weight of grief and trauma. And I think it's just all those things on top of each other can make it very, very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I think every mum, it's always what I try and tell the girls on the bump class, like, don't expect it to be perfect. Because I think especially, we talked to lovely Izzy Judd about, you know, IVF, and, you know, we've got babies that are so longed for, you sort of don't dare to find it hard, and you don't dare to admit that it's hard. But it's hard, it's just as hard, if not harder, if you've gone through a difficult time to get to that stage. Because, you know, for you, just being anxious for 9 months and grieving, that's just, it's like running a marathon before you run the marathon.
Exactly. You're depleted before you even bring this baby home. So you're exhausted. But also you've not really allowed in your mind to sort of prepare for the fact that there's a baby that's going to need looking after. And all those anxieties about bad things happening, I found that didn't go away. It just changed. Because it was a baby that I suddenly had to keep alive outside of me. And my goodness, all these things that could go wrong, it was so overwhelming.
And then I think there's too the idea that if you have another baby and it's well, then that fixes everything. You're suddenly magically cured from the grief that you had. But I mean, you were still grieving for Orla, who was, as you said, a different baby, a different person, a different part of your life. And that just can never go away. Nothing will fix that.
No, no. And I'm infinitely grateful for Esme and the fact that she came when she did. And, you know, I think that I would be very different and things would be very different if she'd come at a different time. But yes, it doesn't take away from what you've been through. And it's just complicated. Loss is complicated. Everyone's journey is so different and so individual, because you arrive at your first pregnancy as an individual person with your own baggage. So of course, how you navigate pregnancy and birth and parenting is going to be unique to you.
And especially if you then don't feel that you can admit that you're still really sad.
Yeah.
You know, people look at you and say, well, you got what you wanted.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think for me, because I felt really, really bad actually, and really struggled those first few months. And again, I just kept coming up with the thought that I'd had when Orla died was, I shouldn't be a parent. I am not cut out for this. The universe told me that I was going to be bad at this. And I am. I'm finding this really hard. I'm not enjoying it. I feel like she would be better off being looked after by someone else who would be better than me. Why didn't I listen to the universe? And the mind is a wonderful thing. It will tell you things that aren't true. But yeah, I think it just made it very difficult to enjoy things when I felt like I had no right to, because I didn't feel good enough.
And did you open up to anyone about how you were feeling?
Not for months. It took me a long time because I just felt, I don't know, it's a weird one. There's a lot of talk, isn't there, online, on social media and things, and it's great. It talks about how difficult parenting is. And I felt, I guess, quite confused. I was like, how I'm feeling, is this the same as what other people are talking about? You know, this sort of like, oh, I don't know whether it's, you know, have off days and good days. Is this what it is? Because if it is, this is actually more miserable than people are letting on. Or is this more? And I found that really hard to tease apart. And, you know, as a psychologist, it's, you know, I kind of thought, gosh, if I'm struggling to tease this apart, how are other people who are really struggling getting on with this? Because I don't know if this is normal or not. I don't know if this is, you know, in inverted commas, normal motherhood, or if this is something different and different, you know, different enough that I need help.
And did you go and have some help in the end?
I did in the end. It took 6 months, and it just got to a point where I just felt, this isn't normal. I should have days where I don't feel like I'm walking through treacle and I feel so anxious all the time. You know, I think the GP sort of thought maybe postnatal depression. I wouldn't disagree with that, but I think it was also anxiety and grief and trauma. And, you know, I don't think it fits under one umbrella, you know, one term. I think it's more of an umbrella thing. But yeah, I went to the GP and said, this is how I'm feeling. And then started going off on one about, oh, but, you know, I might not meet criteria for that service because, you know, I'm getting up every day and I'm going out, and so I can't be that bad. And there's probably people worse off who need that service. And she was just a bit like, look, this is not your decision to make. Don't worry.
Trying to self-diagnose.
Yeah, yeah. And also just rationalise it and kind of go, oh, I'm not worthy of this help. I'm not bad enough. And I suppose when you've worked in mental health for a long time and you see such a huge spectrum, you kind of forget that it is a spectrum and that actually everyone deserves help.
Well, medical professionals are notoriously bad at diagnosing themselves, because it's very difficult to do. You can't live in your own head and look at it objectively. You know, I even see that, you know, with my sister, who's a GP, the way that she sort of treats her children medically is totally different. And it's only because she's emotionally invested in them, and she has a very different relationship than she does with her patients. I mean, she adores her patients, but when you're a mother to that child, it's much more difficult to see, you know, from a slightly detached point of view. And I presume that's the same with you. Yeah. And then, you know, the fact is that, you know, it's a mental health consideration. So are you in the right space to be treating anyone, let alone yourself at this stage?
No, absolutely. So it was, you need someone else to have an objective view on it. But also, like, self-help is great. And I think, you know, we all should be doing sort of some kind of self-care and self-help. But ultimately, we all need someone else. And that might be that you have it in your family, or, you know, a really good, strong network of friends, or... But actually, sometimes you need someone who's completely outside of that, who can say, actually, no, there is more going on. And you're, you know, you can come here and talk really openly, and whatever you say is okay.
Mm. Esme is nearly two now.
She's almost two, yeah.
Nearly two. Have you started talking to her about the fact that she has an older sister?
Yes and no. It's a funny one. Because we have photos up and we've got all his ashes at home. So we do sort of reference another baby and we'll sort of point things out. I think it's probably only now that I could maybe grasp that she might understand some of it, because she can name her friends, for example, from childcare now. And it's when she starts doing that, so I think, okay, and she can name all of our family members. And I just think, okay, well, now maybe is the time to start really talking to her so that she may understand that she has a sister. But I think it's that sort of gently approach, and, you know, not hiding anything, but not also sort of pushing too much, that I don't want to confuse her. It's that she will grow to understand over time, and it's a complex thing to describe to anyone about, well, you've got a sibling and but they're not here. And I think the language that we use, we'll have to think quite carefully about as well.
I think for me, what obviously I had two older children when Willem was stillborn. And one thing that I'm really proud of having done is that he's in the sort of narrative of our everyday conversation. It's not like he's only mentioned on birthdays or when I'm really sad and accompanied by tears. It's almost like we've talked about him so much that he's part of our normal conversation. Yeah. And that makes him feel more present than if he was the sort of unspoken. And weirdly, I went to see a doctor the other day and I had to fill in a sort of form, and I was with one of my children and I said, you know, they said, how many children do you have? And I said, I had two and then a stillbirth. And she said, it was only when my daughter was out of the room, she said, oh, I didn't want to mention this in front of your daughter. And I thought, oh my gosh, I mean, yeah, you could absolutely, the whole family are really happy talking about this. And it probably wasn't something I would have anticipated before I'd experienced stillbirth myself, but I'm really glad we did that because I think it was also taught my children that it's okay to talk about sad things and death and people who've died. And, you know, I'm sure from a professional stance, you'll agree with me that the more we talk about and normalize what is normal in life, the better we are at addressing it and addressing our emotions around it, which might well change person to person,
but also
might change as our lives progress. And it might well be that Iona's really, you know, sad, or Ludo's really sad maybe when he becomes a father because he remembers, you know, his little brother not surviving. So, but I know that he will feel fine to come and talk about it with me because it's been part of our conversation.
Absolutely. I think it's, and often just following their lead is really important, because children have an amazing way of understanding things and putting it into their own words and, you know, sort of coming up with their own sometimes magical kind of explanations for things. And I think it's important to allow them to develop their kind of narrative around it as well. It's part of their discovery of what it is to be alive and then to not be there anymore. And so it's often you learn that initially with pets and things. So it's difficult when it's a sibling, and maybe a sibling that you've never met who came before you. But yeah, we just sort of, I think we sort of gently making sure, I mean, Aula is all around our house. She's everywhere.
I mean, I obviously made the decision not to have another baby after Willem died, and I was really conflicted. I remember waking up on the operating table thinking, there's no way I'm going through this again. And then after a couple of months, I thought, I must have another baby. I want three children. And I remember also thinking, like, it was such a tragedy and people felt so sorry for me. But if I had another baby, it would be like this kind of happy ending and it would cure it. And I remember speaking to my therapist about it. And she said, Marina, you know, having another baby is not going to guarantee that that is a happy ending for you. The only person that will influence that is you. And, you know, actually having another baby could be an even worse ending because of the risks. And anyway, for many reasons, including the fact that I had two healthy children and it was going to be very risky for me to have another baby, we made the difficult decision not to have another baby. But every day I sort of try and think, well, I've got two healthy children. I've got nieces and nephews who I'm a big part of their life. And this house that we're recording in now is constantly full of kids. And I'm so grateful for all of that. But part of it was that I was scared. I was scared to go through a pregnancy where every single twinge in my tummy, was that just I had a bit of wind, or was that I was having another placental abruption? And I just thought the impact that would have on me, on my children, my husband. So I wasn't as brave as you. But if someone's listening to this thinking, I don't know if I can do this, you know, what would you say to them? What surprised you about? I mean, did you ever think, I can't just do another pregnancy? Or were you just pregnant before you thought about it too much?
I think for me, that was the issue, that it was just so soon that there wasn't really rational thought. It was just this instinctive, well, that's it, we're going to try for another one. And it happened very quickly. We were very lucky. So there wasn't thinking until then. I had to think about, oh my goodness, how am I going to get through these next 9 months? I think everyone's so unique, because, you know, people will have to consider different things, because some people already have children and some don't. And there's always weighing up, what's the impact going to be? I think also, you know, the health implications, because some people may have an explanation, some people don't. Sometimes you need to wait months for test results. So I think everyone needs to sort of make their own decision and feel that they have the right to make the decision that's right for them, but also that you're not alone in making that. So talking to people, either other people who've gone through it or professionals, you know, speaking to a therapist, speaking to bereavement midwives and medical consultants and whoever it is that you can speak to help you make an informed decision. Because I think making a decision based on your emotions, you know, it's very lonely and it's a very kind of scary place to be. And there are resources out there. I think the trouble is they're very hard to find. And I think that's what I find really, it makes me feel really sad that if you don't know where to find that support, you might not know, you might not have someone to talk about these things to.
Yeah, but you should try and find, because it is theoretically available if you've had a loss beforehand. I mean, theoretically you should. It's about asking those questions. But a lot of people don't realise that that is a service that is available.
Because it's not like one set service. Mm. I think that's the problem. So, you know, there's lots of amazing charities and organisations that offer free counselling. Mm. You know, some people will go to their bereavement midwife if there is one available in their hospital. You know, it's... I think that's the trouble, sort of, you know, I'd love to be able to say this is where you should go, but actually it's going to be different depending on where you live.
Mm.
And I mean, this is the travesty of healthcare, that it is often a postcode lottery. Mm. I mean, there's great organisations like Tommy's and Sands and, you know, other charities that do help people to think these things through. But ultimately, it's just so individual. Mm. It's really hard to give specific advice.
And I suppose, you know, having, you know, the knowledge that hopefully you'll be able to find someone not only to help you make that decision, but if you do decide to go through another pregnancy, to support you in that pregnancy. Yeah. And that sort of seeing someone and talking to them and being able to manage, you know, you talked about how you managed your anxiety.
Yeah.
That actually these tools can be really, really helpful. I remember speaking to a hypnotherapist actually, and she said, you know, part of what I do is, you know, speaking to people who've experienced loss and teaching them little techniques to help with the anxiety. And we're very, very different. It's not like there's one size fits all. No. But, you know, those things are often incredibly helpful. And also the understanding that, you know, generally, and I know, again, care across the NHS differs hugely, but if you have experienced a stillbirth or a loss late on in pregnancy, they usually are pretty good at caseloading you and making sure that you all have that continuity of care.
Exactly.
And they try and help with the burden. They try and provide someone that you can talk to, that can reassure you. They give you more scans, obviously.
Absolutely, yeah.
And they are understanding, aren't they?
They are. And I think also that you, if you don't have someone who is advocating for you, sometimes you need to be your own advocate, which is really hard when you're feeling very vulnerable. I would say to anyone, if you're thinking about having another pregnancy or you are pregnant again, try to get a caseloading midwife if that exists in your local area, because just like you say, continuity of care is just like that just makes all the difference.
You're not having to explain
every time
that you had a stillbirth and
exactly
being asked sort of insensitive questions.
I know. And like, you know, people, you know, I don't like labeling people as good or bad clinicians. I think, you know, everyone's working under a lot of pressure in the NHS. But I think, you know, some people are just have the language. They're just very good at managing this stuff. And some people are less good at that. So finding those people that you're like, okay, I trust them and I want to see them, and doing as much as you can to kind of get that, because you deserve it. And ultimately, I mean, I could go off on a big rant here about cost effectiveness, but if you get the right care early on, it does make a massive difference. And I think it sets you up in a way that sets you up in a good way for those early days and weeks of motherhood, which are hard anyway.
On your website you have little stickers for your maternity notes, which basically is saying that you are pregnant after a loss.
Actually, the ones that I've done, because you can get the pregnancy ones, for me it was after that. So we did the I'm parenting after loss stickers, because I found going, oh gosh, this is bringing back memories up, going to like weigh-in clinics with the health visitor, and I would see someone different every time, and it was giving over that red book and people saying, oh, is she your first? And thinking, oh, why? I feel really vulnerable here. I'm a new mum. I feel like everyone's staring at me, trying to undress my screaming baby to put her on the scales. And I really don't want that extra stress of having to explain again. No, a year ago, my first baby died. And that's why I'm probably feeling a little bit more stressed than maybe I would have done otherwise.
Mm. because there's also that sort of, very often that question is chit-chat. You know, it's not that they need to know. Yeah. It's chit-chat. Oh, aren't you having a nice day? And then you feel like you're delivering the worst news and you're ruining everyone's day.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, that just makes your day even worse.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough, that question, you know, how many children do you have is a difficult one. And I find myself, sometimes I'm honest and sometimes I say I should have had three.
Yeah.
I had three, but I only have two now. But also some days I just find myself saying I've got two children and not feeling brave enough to have that conversation. And sometimes I think you have to be pragmatic. And
you do. And I think you just have to be kind to yourself. That doesn't mean that you're a bad person or that you're forgetting your child by not saying that. Like, I just always think, does this person deserve that piece of my heart? Because I feel like every time I talk about Orla, I am opening my heart and giving a little bit of it away. And some people I feel can manage that and can treat that bit of my heart with tenderness. And if I don't feel that they can do that, then I'm not going to take that risk.
Mm.
And I feel okay about that. Mm. I don't, you know, I might go away and in my head I have a little chat with Orla and say, they just didn't deserve to hear about you. And because you're just too precious for me to share you.
Oh, well, I think that is a wonderful way to think about it. Whether or not they deserve a piece of your heart, that's great. Michelle, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah,
I feel so proud to be part of what I think is a very brave and important conversation. And I guarantee we will have comforted and helped people who will be listening to this. Dear Orla blog has changed. It's now from the other chair.
From the other chair. So yeah, that's changed. Last year it was kind of a difficult decision, because again it's this sort of like, actually I felt like I was letting go a bit of Orla. But I guess as time went on and I had some therapy, I've had quite a bit of therapy now after Esme was born, and I just felt that where I was at with my writing had changed. And being someone who's now sat in both chairs as a therapist and psychologist and as someone who has been in therapy, that's where I felt like I was coming from with my writing. And again, sort of had lots of chats with Orla in my mind about, it doesn't mean that I've forgotten her, that I've moved on in any way. It's just that, you know, she's given me the strength and bravery to talk about other things and make some very big decisions and changes in my life, and I feel very grateful to her for that.
Mm. And the blog is obviously a collection of your writing, but also other people sharing their stories.
Yeah. So using the whole concept of letters as well, sort of writing letters to either an aspect of them or a mental health difficulty or someone else, you know, a health professional or whoever that may be, writing a therapeutic letter to that person who's in the other chair or that part of them in the other chair. I have to say, it's taken a bit of a back seat at the moment, but I've got some letters coming up that I'm going to be sharing. So.
Well, and the reason it's taken a back seat is because you're working again.
I am, yes. Yeah, I went back to work last year, almost a year ago in the NHS, and made the decision at the end of last year that I was going to leave, which is a very big one after 15 years. That's a tough a process, I would say, that's been full of tears and angst. But it goes back to what I was saying about, I feel that Orla and Esme actually have given me the strength and the bravery to make decisions that actually fit for me and my family.
So you're practicing privately, so people can come and see you if they want to chat. I mean, do you specialise in grief and...
No, I mean, I've sort of stuck with what I know from what I've been doing for years. So I specialise in working with adults. So I work with just, you know, as psychologists, we're quite handy that we're trained in a whole range of different models and for helping lots of different difficulties. So whilst grief and bereavement have been things that I've worked with in the past, it's not something I'm specialising in. I just specialise in people. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in people and their unique stories and, you know, their unique difficulties. So yeah, that's what I work with.
If people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way of getting in touch and just learning a bit more about what you do?
So I mean, you can have a look on the blog, which is From the Other Chair, and my new, I don't know what to call it, kind of venture. I'll call it a venture because it's, although it's private
adventure.
Practice. Adventure. Yeah, absolutely. It's a private practice, but actually part of this is that we're going to be offering, we're a social enterprise, so we are going to be offering free support. So some interventions, some kind of just support groups to people who need it, and focusing actually on people who've gone through loss. So whilst my therapeutic work is with anyone. Actually, some of the support that we're giving for free is going to focus more on people who've been through loss. And this venture is called Talking Heads. So that's talkingheads.org.uk. Yeah, and that's launching now. So it's very exciting.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Michelle. Thanks so much for coming along
to chat.
Thank
you for having me. It's really nice to talk about something that I'm sure there's lots of people out there who are sort of either about to tread this line or already are.
Thank you all for listening to another episode of The Parenthood. I had a comment on Instagram this week which made me so happy. She said, "You take all these taboos and make them seem so normal." And I hope that's what we've continued to do in that vein today. The loss of a child is never easy to talk about, but God, it's important. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate and review us. You can also get in touch with me. Let us know what you want to hear about next on my Instagram. I'm marina.fogel. But in the meantime, from Michelle and me, thank you for listening and goodbye.
Thank you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.